Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role did U.S. foreign policy play in the historic political and economic upheavals in the Middle East in the 1970s, which saw a shift from our dependence for oil, and our primary allegiance from the Shah's Iran to Saudi Arabia? And to what extent are Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, and especially Henry Kissinger to blame for the existence of a hostile Iran armed with U.S. weapons and technology? Andrew Scott Cooper is a Ph.D. candidate in American history with advanced degrees in journalism from Columbia University and strategic studies from the University of Aberdeen. He traces the shifting sands of 1970s petropolitics in his new book, The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. Andrew, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me.
We should probably start with this because it's an easy fact to forget. In the late 1960s, the U.S. was the largest producer of oil in the world. By 1977, we were the largest importer of oil in the world.
Yes, it's something that we tend to forget now. The U.S. was self-sufficient in oil production. And then in 1970, that was really the moment where U.S. oil production peaked and began to tail off. And that is also a very important moment in the history of the energy markets, because that's when the U.S. enters the world energy market in much the same way that China is entering the world energy market now. And what happened in the early 1970s is that with the U.S. then having to go onto the market to buy oil, they began to compete for limited supplies and often against their friends in the Western industrialized world.
So how did OPEC go from being what was primarily a sort of economic alliance to an organization that also intended to wield political power?
Well, that's really the story of the Shah, I think. The Shah saw OPEC as the vehicle for him to obtain the oil revenues that would allow him to modernize Iran and transform Iran into a military and economic powerhouse within his lifetime. I mean, this is that the Shah was moving very quickly, and he quite cleverly, I think, saw that OPEC could allow him to do that. And at that time, Iran had 32 million people. It was the largest member of OPEC, certainly militarily was the most dominant, and that gave him a great deal of sway. And he was very close to Nixon. And with the other members of OPEC, he was able to say to them, I'll handle the Americans. Don't worry, we're going to get higher prices, and let's do it my way.
And we should say that at the time, Iran had a very important security function in the Gulf.
Absolutely. Iran at that time, well, in 1969, when Nixon came in, Iran was regarded as a junior client state. When Nixon came to power, he had known the Shah since the early 1950s. He admired the Shah. He visited Tehran in 1967 before he became president. And when Nixon came in, he really wanted to help the Shah modernize Iran. And U.S. officials saw Iran as, it's been called the gendarme of the Persian Gulf or the centurion of the Persian Gulf for the U.S. and for the West. And so Iran held a very special place in Western strategic architecture, because at that time, the Middle East was in turmoil. The Shah was unabashedly pro-Western and pro-U.S. The Shah had very close ties to the Israelis. It's also something that we don't think about now. Iran and Israel were very close at that time. And for those reasons, U.S. officials were more prepared to trust the Shah to handle U.S. defense responsibilities in the Persian Gulf.
And we were quite willing to sell them weapons.
Yeah, well, yes, to an extent. I mean, really it changed with Nixon, because until Nixon came in, U.S. officials had been very much aware that the Shah had a tendency to overspend money on advanced weaponry. And I mean in terms of hundreds of millions of dollars, and then later billions. And they always linked economic stability in Iran to political stability. There was always the fear of unrest and even revolution in Iran. We now know that U.S. officials had been keeping close tabs on the Iranian economy right up until 1972. And when Nixon came in, he was inclined to give the Shah whatever he wanted. And actually, he and Kissinger had sound, you could say they had sound geopolitical reasons for doing that. But it also came out of a position of weakness on the U.S. part, because with Vietnam winding down, the administration really needed someone to anchor U.S. interests in the Persian Gulf, West Asian area. And the Shah stepped up to the plate and said, I'm quite happy to do it for you, but if I take over, if I manage the burden of Western defense interests, you have to lift restrictions on arms sales to my country. And when they did that, when Nixon and Kissinger did that in 1972, they basically removed all the, they surrendered their own strategic leverage over an ally. And no other ally in U.S. ally has ever had restrictions on conventional non-nuclear weaponry lifted before. Hmm. Not the British, not the Israelis, not the West Germans. So that's where the Shah also had a very unique relationship.
How did Iran's neighbors feel about this unfettered buildup of heavy weaponry?
Well, the U.S. Defense Department predicted in advance what would happen. And in fact, they, far from wanting to pour weapons into Iran, we now know that Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird and then Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger tried to resist the arms sales. They certainly questioned them, and they challenged the strategic logic of this decision to lift restrictions, because they quite rightly said, if you lift restrictions on Iran, neighboring Iraq is going to get closer to the Soviet Union. They're going to seek weapons from the Soviets. It's going to pull them in closer to the communist bloc, and it's going to start a regional arms race within the Persian Gulf. Hmm. And those predictions from the late 1960s, it did come to pass, because by 1975, you see Iraq under Saddam Hussein's control, because Saddam Hussein is already the young guy pulling the strings in Iraq at this time. Iraq becomes more militant, becomes more radicalized. And it's also important, I think, to realize with Iran and Iraq at this time, they had nationalist rivalries, and they both saw the U.S. and the Soviet Union as a way to play the great powers off against each other to get what they wanted.
And it certainly worked from the U.S. perspective. As Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger was very much influenced by the fact that he viewed the Shah as a reliable ally against communism.
Yes, he did. And he liked to think that he had a very close relationship with the Shah. And certainly, since the revolution, there has been enormous interest in his relationship with the Shah. What did he know? What did he say to the Shah? What was going on in Iran? Did he know what was going on in Iran in the 1970s? And the documentation that's come out now is fascinating, because in many respects, the Shah was the one who was manipulating the administration and certainly manipulating Kissinger. It's not to say that the Shah wasn't a U.S. ally. He was, but he had his own national interests to look after. And Kissinger repeatedly underestimated the power of nationalism on the Iranian side.
Hmm. Kissinger also would have information and fail to share it with the salient members of his team so that they could work together on deciding what to do with it.
Yes, that's certainly the case. We now know that there's one remarkable transcript that I came across where in August of 1974, Gerald Ford had been in office a week, and Kissinger had a briefing with him. It was a Saturday morning. They had a briefing in the Oval Office, and they talked about Iran and the Shah and OPEC. And this is just a couple of 6 months after, 9 months, I should say, after oil prices had quadrupled, triggering the first oil shock. And there was a lot of pressure within the administration to talk to the Shah. A lot of officials wanted the president and Kissinger to say to the Shah, you have to restrain oil prices because you could tip us into another Great Depression. And Kissinger said to Ford, we don't want to put too much pressure on the Shah because we could break him. And what he meant was, the Shah's regime is not as strong as everyone likes to think it is. and too much U.S. pressure on the Shah might actually trigger instability inside Iran. And at this time, the perception, the public perception, but even the perception in Washington was that the Shah's dictatorship was rock solid. Hmm. Kissinger knew better than that. And he knew that the Shah was very much dependent on U.S. Support from the outside.
Let's talk about the Shah's acceptance internally. First of all, what sort of leader was he of his own people?
Well, I think until the late 1960s, probably until the early 1970s, he was not loved, but he was respected. Mm-hmm. He was regarded as a man who was bringing his country into the 20th century. He'd been on the throne since 1941, and it's another thing we tend to forget. He was actually the king of Iran for 37 years. So he'd come onto the throne as a young man, and he'd been the first 10 years or so of his reign were very unstable, and Iran had been a very unstable country as recently as 1963, which is when Ayatollah Khomeini emerges on the scene for the first time. But after Khomeini is sent into exile after violent unrest that year, the Shah really begins to, he has the field is clear, you could say. He is running the country on his own. And as long as the Iranian economy was doing well, the Iranian people were behind him. We see a turn in 1971 when the Shah decides to celebrate he throws a huge party for the 2,500th anniversary of the Iranian monarchy. And this is where the security forces, SAVAK, begin to create real problems internally and turning people against the regime. But it is the case that so long as the Iranian economy was doing well, he had public opinion behind him.
So in 1973, you have what you alluded to earlier, this OPEC embargo of oil sales. And the primary motivator there was U.S. and Western European support for Israel?
Yes. And again, we now know that there were warnings before that happened. King Faisal of Saudi Arabia sent word to the U.S., to the administration, if the Arab states go to war against Israel, and if you do an airlift, if you supply the Israelis with weapons, if you support them, we will cut off the oil supply. Faisal, by the way, was very much backed into a corner at this time, mm-hmm. because the other Arab states were radicalizing, and Muammar Gaddafi played a key role in this time. Faisal tried to say, look, I don't want to cut off oil, but I'll have to in order to save my own throne and save my position here. And that is exactly what happened. They cut the oil off. The U.S. administration had tried desperately to separate the politics from the economics of the Middle East, and they couldn't do it. And they couldn't do it then, and they can't do it now, because everything is very much tied up.
Andrew Scott Cooper is my guest. He's a PhD candidate in American history with advanced degrees in strategic studies from the University of Aberdeen and journalism from Columbia University. His new book is called The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. Join our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Andrew Scott Cooper. He's a PhD candidate in American history and author of the new book, The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So you had this oil embargo in 1973, but at the end of the year, the Shah is still writing an order for a great deal of U.S.-produced weapons.
Yes, that's absolutely right. The Shah saw his moment to finally get oil prices up to a point where he could generate enough revenues to buy all the weapons he wanted to after Nixon and Kissinger lifted restrictions on weapon sales. He had, you know, he could essentially write out a free check.
Mm-hmm.
There was something else Nixon and Kissinger had done, though, a couple of years earlier, which has remained secret until this time. Nixon sent the Shah word that he would not oppose oil price increases if the Shah needed to raise more money to buy weapons. But what happened in December 73 is that the Shah went way over what Nixon and Kissinger ever expected, whereas they thought he might want to raise prices by maybe a dollar or two a barrel. The Shah raised them by $7. So by the end of 1973, oil prices have quadrupled in price. That is a massive shock to the global economy. And Nixon sends the Shah a letter and says this could have potentially catastrophic implications for financial networks and for the banking sector. The Shah was looking for billions of dollars because he had already placed orders for $5 billion worth of U.S. military equipment, and he needed to pay for it somehow. And this was the fastest way he could do it. His thinking seems to have been that the Western countries have had it good for a long time. Oil prices have been kept artificially low. It's time for the Iranian people to take control of their own destinies, and I'm going to get what's mine. And he did. And at that period in late 73, Nixon and Kissinger were very concerned about what was happening. But the U.S. was quite weak at that time. Vietnam had ended, and the oil embargo was still in place. The Shah did not participate in the oil embargo. And that meant that the U.S. needed Iran to keep producing oil at full capacity. And they needed to keep the Shah, to some extent, they needed to appease him. And so there was a trade-off there. They had to let the oil price increase go through because they were afraid that if they didn't, the Shah would retaliate by joining the embargo.
And meanwhile, you have the Secretary of the Treasury and others within the U.S. government who don't know about these deals saying, why in the world, Nixon and Kissinger, have you not approached the Shah about dropping the price?
Yes, and this is where we are introduced to Bill Simon, who was the Treasury Secretary at the time, and I think is a fascinating guy. In terms of my research, I really did not expect him to play any sort of role in the policy disputes, but he quickly, from 1973 onwards, he becomes this key opponent of the Shah within the Nixon and Ford administrations. Bill Simon was, I guess you could call him a free market traditional free marketeer. He was definitely on the conservative side of the Republican Party, and he was solely interested in the financial implications of the oil shock. He believed that the key to breaking high oil prices was to get in behind the Saudis. Now, it's important to understand that the Shah wanted to increase oil prices quickly. The Saudis also wanted to increase oil prices, but they believed that it was better to make the changes incrementally. They opposed massive increases precisely because an oil shock would hurt the economies of their trading partners, the U.S. and the other Western countries, and it would also strengthen the forces of international communism, and King Faisal was very anti-communist. So Bill Simon builds an alliance with Sheikh Yamani, the Saudi oil minister. They develop a friendship. And over the years, we see their friendship begin to change thinking within, especially within the Ford administration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so by summer of 1974, you have Simon and others in the U.S. government sending at least tacit messages to the Saudis that they would be willing, we would be willing to switch allegiances.
I think what they were trying to say is that we would like to see Saudi Arabia exert its authority within OPEC. Mm-hmm. We believe, you know, the Shah has been our ally geopolitically, but financially and economically, he is really straining ties with us, and we need you to start exerting your voice and your influence within OPEC. The Saudis were then, as they are now, the largest oil producer within OPEC, and so they're called the swing producer because they had excess capacity, and that meant that if they suddenly decided to pump more oil into the market, they could force prices down. They could actually flood the market. And the Saudis at that time in 74 were very nervous because it was a very small, lightly populated country. Mm-hmm. They knew that everyone wanted their oil, and it was, on the one hand, they could say, well, you know, we could follow you, the U.S., and we could do this, but we're so far away from you. How could we, you know, we're in a sea of radicalism, and it could lead to instability within Saudi Arabia if we're perceived to be getting too close to the U.S. So there was a dance going on for several years while the Saudis got to the point where they felt confident enough to challenge the Shah within OPEC.
So when they finally did that, the Saudis announced that they were going to break with OPEC and they were going to undercut OPEC's prices per barrel of oil.
Yeah, in late 1976, throughout 1976, as the world economy had started to pick up in early 1976 from the oil shock, this is where there are some interesting parallels with what we see now. The perception was that the U.S. was coming out of a very severe recession, the worst since the Great Depression. But in the summer of 1976, U.S. productivity and U.S. economic growth stalled, and this is known as the Greenspan pause, after Alan Greenspan, who miscalculated spending on stimulus money. They underspent. They had a stimulus package. They underspent, and the stimulus package could not get the U.S. economy out of the recession in 76. So they had a real problem on their hands, and they realized we could be headed into a double-dip recession. But worse than that, U.S. banks on Wall Street are overextended because they have given out so many loans to indebted countries in Europe and in the third world, that one default somewhere along the line could trigger the collapse of a big U.S. bank. Hmm. Now, one of those banks was Bank of America, which at the time was the biggest bank in the world. The others were Chase and Citi, and then we had Morgan Guarantee Corporation, which is now Morgan, J.P. Morgan. And so you see this constellation of factors coming together in late 1976, and the U.S. needed relief on oil prices, and they needed it urgently, they believed, to prevent a financial catastrophe.
What sort of political risks were there even in late 1976 to Saudi Arabia breaking with OPEC?
Well, the biggest risk would be from an internal subversion, revolt within the military, and a military coup probably. There was also the chance of unrest in the eastern provinces, which is where most of the oil is located. Mm-hmm. The eastern province of Saudi Arabia there's a large Shia community there. And, of course, the Iranians are Shia and the Saudis are Sunni Arab. And so there's unrest in that area. That's sort of an underclass. They have not enjoyed the full benefits of being Saudi citizens. And there could have been unrest in oil country, and then, of course, within the military, there was a great deal of impatience with the cautious conservatism of the Saudi royal family. So, yes, I mean, if the Saudis stood up to the Iranians, they risked instability within Saudi Arabia.
So you have all this brewing, the Saudis at least considering breaking from OPEC and selling oil to Western Europe and to the United States. Meanwhile, the Shah of Iran had visited Washington in spring of 1975, and it was a really, it's sort of a cringeworthy series of events. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened there?
Yes, the Shah comes to Washington in 1975, and U.S. on the outside, U.S.-Iran relations are very good, and the Shah is hailed as America's most important ally now. I mean, Iran is this great petropower. Behind the scenes, there was real trouble, and there was real tension over oil prices. And we have there's just a great moment where the Shah's limousine is driving up, almost about to come up to the White House, and Kissinger says to Ford, "Oh, by the way, we told the Shah we would support a paratroop operation in Saudi Arabia, so just tell him you know that would be happening if there was a crisis."
It's hard to believe that Kissinger could get away with this kind of insubordination.
Kissinger got away with a lot under Ford. He got away with, to an extent, under Nixon. But you know, Gerry Ford was a different guy. He admired Kissinger like everyone did on the outside at that time. Nixon understood Kissinger's devious side, mm-hmm. and kept tabs on him and tormented him. Ford was much more trusting, and Ford he was a team player in terms of how he managed his administration. And there's this, you know, the transcript of the meeting in the Oval Office with there's the Shah and there's Kissinger and there's Ford, and then Brent Scowcroft was taking the notes, and I interviewed him for the book. And there's this great moment where, you know, in some respects, when you're looking at this meeting, Ford is almost like a bystander watching Kissinger and the Shah just completely absorbed with each other. But it's very clear also that as the Shah is talking, he's very much out of touch with what's going on in Washington. And there's a moment where he says, well, yes, you know, if we do have that operation in Saudi Arabia, we should get the Egyptians in. And although Nixon and Kissinger have approved this contingency plan 2 years earlier, one of the reasons for having contingency plans was to prevent Egypt from becoming a big power in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And here you have the Shah thinking, well, we should have Egyptian troops join the Iranians by going into Saudi Arabia. So there's a complete disconnect going on between the people in the room and their respective positions.
Did Kissinger simply not understand, or did he not care about the effect that all of these policies could potentially have on the domestic U.S. economy?
I don't think he understood. Mm-hmm. Kissinger is a geopolitical strategist. He did not have... much of even an interest or a firm grasp in economics. And actually, to be fair to him at that time, this globalized economy was just coming in, and the Cold War was the Cold War, and the world was a chessboard for Kissinger, and also for the Shah and for Nixon. I mean, the Shah and Nixon and Kissinger got on so well together because they treated countries like pawns on a chessboard. But Kissinger really... there's also ego comes into it, because he had the people around him who could have helped. He did have, there were people in the administration who said to him, if you do this, if you lift restrictions on arms sales, if you give the Shah everything he wants, it could not only destabilize Iran internally, but it could cause real economic problems for the U.S. And that's exactly what happened. This 1973 oil shock is a turning point for the West.
My guest is Andrew Scott Cooper. He's a PhD candidate in American history. His new book is called The Oil Kings. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So ultimately, Saudi Arabia does break with OPEC, undercut oil sales, and then you have much of OPEC and certainly Iran really suffering from that loss of revenue. Talk about what happened internally within Iran when that money stopped flowing.
Yeah, that's the Saudis decided in late 76 that they would not abide by the Shah's desire to increase oil prices for 1977, and that meant that they were prepared to use their swing power, which meant they pumped millions and millions of barrels of oil into the market, flooded the market. The Shah had been depending on that money, and he'd been promised that money, by the way, by Kissinger. Kissinger had said to him, don't raise oil prices until the 1977 1976 presidential election is out the way. If you can just keep the oil prices low until Ford gets elected, then raise them. And so the Shah had that deal. And then but he really needed the money because he'd overspent too and Iran was indebted. When that money didn't come through in 1977, the Shah's government was forced to retrench, and they implemented a very, very harsh austerity budget. They slashed spending. I mean, you could look at what's happening in Greece now in terms of what happens to a country that suddenly puts the brakes on spending. It's very, very dangerous. And what happened in Iran is that many, many thousands of people were thrown out of work. Many of them were and the building and construction sector collapsed. Many of the people who worked on building sites were young men from the provinces. Mm. They were more conservative. They were more religious inclined. Suddenly they were out of work, standing on street corners in South Tehran. And the burden of the spending cuts fell on the poor and working class Iranians. Middle class Iranians began to panic. And this is where you see real discontent with the Shah's regime start to boil to the surface.
And this had been the thing that Kissinger in some ways had feared all along. It simply happened by a different set of circumstances than he imagined.
Yes. When he said to, he said to Ford once, he said to Ford actually in 1976, if we get rid of the Shah, we'll have a radical Iran on our hands. He didn't mean that the U.S. would throw the Shah out. What he meant was that there's always the potential for instability in Iran, and that because the Shah is a pro-Western monarch, he needs moral support and assurance from us. Kissinger's fear was always that the Shah would be, the revolution in Iran would come from the left. There would be a communist or radical nationalist rebellion against the Shah's rule, but it would come from the left. And the Shah believed that too. Actually, the threat comes to the Shah from the right. Now, this doesn't make sense because the Shah is a right-wing authoritarian king, dictator.
Let me jump in here. We need to take a quick break, and I want you to be able to finish your thought. My guest is Andrew Scott Cooper. We're talking this hour about his new book, The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. Our number, 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Andrew Scott Cooper, author of the new book, The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. You can join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. Before the break, Andrew, you were telling us that both the Shah and Kissinger had assumed that if there was a challenge to the Shah's authority, it would come from the far left on the communist side. But, in fact, it ended up coming from a position farther to the right than the Shah.
Yes, it came from Ayatollah Khomeini, who was languishing in exile. Initially the unrest was economically based, because you had so many people unemployed, there was a lot of distress, and the Shah's promises of building a great civilization had been exposed essentially as bankrupt, and the Shah himself says to one of his closest aides in January 1977, "We're broke," and the aide says to him, his close aide writes in his diary that we've been checkmated by the Saudis and the Americans. Hmm. The collapse in Iranian revenue in early 1977 led to this austerity budget. Big spending projects were curtailed or cut, and the Shah, from then on, is adrift, and Iran is adrift. And, of course, at this time, too, he has cancer, and no one knows that.
And the U.S. had indications that this was the case, that the Shah's health was failing, but ignored them?
Well, this is really like a detective story, because there's been so much debate over the years about who knew and even whether the Shah knew. I mean, the discussion among a lot of Iranian exiles is whether the news was kept from the Shah by his own doctors. I believe that he did know, and he was diagnosed in Austria in early 1974. By the summer, fall of 1975, Tehran is awash with rumors that something is wrong in the palace, that there's something wrong with the Shah. And Ambassador Helms, Richard Helms, who had been the Nixon's director of the CIA, confronts the Shah and says to him, "Your Majesty, I'm hearing that you're being treated by French doctors. Can you please tell me what's going on?" And his recollection was that the Shah lied to him. The Shah said, "Well, you know, there are rumors about my health all the time. I'm just being treated for something minor, and there's nothing to worry about." And I think he joked his way out of it. And Helms believed him. He believed him because, partly because, I think, of arrogance, that he and Kissinger thought they had a real, they had much more knowledge of what was going on inside Iran than they really did. But also the Shah was perceived, he was young. He was still at that time in his 50s. The idea that the Shah of Iran could be dying was inconceivable because the U.S. had invested so much in him. There's a point at which officials start to suspend, they start to believe what they want to believe about this guy.
It's like magical thinking.
It is. That's a very good way of thinking about it, actually. And all the way through, in fact, this period, you see magical thinking on the part of U.S. officials. By the way, they were, people were saying to them that things were going wrong and that the Shah was ill. And no, he can't be ill because he can't be ill because we've just sold him $10 billion worth of military equipment.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Ario in Dallas. Hi, Ario.
Yes, thank you so much, Chris, for this great show. And thanks to Mr. Cooper for this well-documented interview. I have a question. In line up with what has been told by Mr. Cooper, does he think that at a certain time, a kind of parallel portion of the U.S. government or intelligence had some role in how you call it, helping the unrest toward the benefit of at least a faction of the Ayatollah Khomeini coalition? And if not, what was the reason that somebody who normally was supposed to be well-knowledged, well-educated, well-documented at least, like Ramsey Clark, who was Jimmy Carter's Ministry of Justice, went to see somebody as backwarded, as lunatic, as Ayatollah Khomeini, who his ideas were already inside a book about the creation of an Islamic State, and worst of all, Ramsey Clark qualifying such individual as the Gandhi of his time. Also, I would appreciate if Mr. Cooper can, by any chance, provide an email address or a Facebook address or so. I'm sure that a lot of Iranians eager like myself are very eager to hear about his comments and his views about this about the whole issue.
Let's get a response for you. Thank you so much for your call, Ario.
Yes, I mean, the book is on Facebook, and I'm on Facebook too, so it's either Andrew Scott Cooper or the Oil Kings, and that the two are linked. Yes, I mean, that's an interesting question. Well, about the U.S. officials, there are many theories that the U.S. played a direct role in overthrowing the Shah and bringing Khomeini back. I tend to think the truth is more banal, and sometimes the truth is more difficult to accept because it's so banal. What we do know is that some U.S. officials, particularly within the intelligence and military communities, were very concerned about the Shah's behavior by 1976. They opposed the sale of nuclear reactors and nuclear fuel to Iran. Another deal that was approved by Nixon and Kissinger secretly. But that didn't mean that they wanted to see the Shah replaced. It meant that some of them, and I mean some, were coming to believe that the Shah's policies were destabilizing not only Iran, but also the world economy. However, they were not involved in any effort to against the Shah, partly because there was no replacement for the Shah at that time. I mean, there really was no replacement. In terms of the Khomeini's writings about establishing an Islamic state, there's one little story I'll tell you that I think is a good indication of U.S. policy at that time. In 1975, when the Shah came to the White House, Betty Ford asked Anne Margaret, a big Hollywood star at that time, to dance for the Shah and for the Shahbanu. And this is quite an amazing scene because Anne Margaret essentially performed a striptease on stage in front of the defender of the faith of Shia Islam. And I asked General Scowcroft afterwards, when I interviewed him last year, I said, "Were you in the room at that time? What did you think about that?" And he said, "Oh, yes." He said, "I never forgot that." And I said, "Well, do you know that those scenes were televised and sent back to Tehran, and that they helped mobilize support against the Shah because he had an American woman stripping in front of him?" And he said to me, and it was a very honest thing he said. He said, "Shia, Sunni, we just didn't know." Hmm. And it's important to understand that at that time, U.S. officials did not take religion into account when they were working with national security issues. It was geopolitics and the Cold War. The idea that you had Shia Islam and Sunni Islam was really not understood. That was something academics were interested in. How could that impact our Cold War geocalculations?
Did those blinders stay on up through 9/11, do you think?
Oh, I think they did. Mm-hmm. I think they did, yes. I mean, they're certainly off now, but yes, I think they certainly did.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Jim on the line in Dallas. Hello, Jim.
Thank you. One thing I do know from having lived through this is that the Iranis, and I know plenty of them, wanted to be differentiated as Persians as opposed to Arabs.
Yes.
And I think that was a significant factor in how a lot of what evolved as a tension between U.S. and Iran eventually was based on. Also, I wanted to ask, you know, the Iranis had this immensely old culture and history as a particular people, as Persians. And I think that the United States decided at some point that the Arabs in Saudi Arabia were far easier to deal with than this extremely educated and culture-bound Iran.
I agree with you there. I think that Persian culture, the Shah was a Persian nationalist, essentially, and this is where the clash with the Americans comes in, is they can't, because they don't take culture and religion into account when they're developing national security, the Shah's behavior is puzzling to them. And in fact, the CIA does this analysis and decides the Shah is mentally ill because he's not cooperating with the U.S. In fact, the Shah was a Persian nationalist and was looking after his own interests. The Saudis were very willing to cooperate with the U.S. go all the way. The Shah made it clear he would cooperate, but on his terms. And so, yes, I think that's a good point, that Persian culture was very puzzling to the Americans who were pouring into Iran at that point. We have to remember that on the eve of the revolution, there were at least 45,000 to 50,000 American nationals living in Iran.
How fully formed were the U.S. plans to potentially send troops to the Persian Gulf to break the Arab oil embargo?
Oh, gosh, we now know that the Marines were getting into place, let's put it that way. Previously it was just a rumor or it was speculated about, but I spoke to the Secretary of Defense at the time, Schlesinger, and there was a carrier group moving into position. The Marines were being assembled, and he had decided that if they were going to go in, they were going to go into Abu Dhabi. At that time, the U.S. was not, was regarded, even within the administration, they regarded the U.S. as still struggling after Vietnam, and they could not have mounted a full-scale invasion. But he wanted to make a point to the Arabs that you can't strangle the United States. And if you try, we will come right into the heart of oil country and we'll put some troops in there and that will break the embargo. And that's why they settled on Abu Dhabi. It was quite small, it was undefended, and the oil minister of that country, who was only 27 years old, had been the first one to, in fact, declare the embargo.
Could we have handled this better if we weren't so very distracted by Vietnam and by the Watergate scandal?
Yes. I mean, Nixon's position after Watergate weakened him to the point where he did not have any leverage over the Shah. The Shah, by the way, understood this brilliantly.
Mm-hmm.
The Shah understood that with Nixon weakening, he was now going to become stronger. Although I think he miscalculated ultimately because Nixon was protecting the Shah to an extent. So yes, Watergate definitely caused great complications, and I have some examples of that in the book. And Vietnam at that point sent a message to the rest of the world that the U.S. was not prepared to stand by allies. And it's, when you review the transcripts of the conversations Kissinger's having with foreign leaders, this comes up again and again and again, that the U.S. is abandoning South Vietnam, so you're going to abandon Israel as well. And that means that we're going to start acting up. And in fact, that's really what happens at this time.
Can you spend the last minute or so that we have talking about your research process for this book and what you were able to get declassified that had not been available to scholars before you took this on?
Well, the big addition to the literature are the transcripts of Brent Scowcroft.
Mm-hmm.
Scowcroft was the note taker for Kissinger from 73 onwards, and then he succeeded Kissinger as National Security Advisor in late 75. And he kept very carefully worded notes of all the meetings between in the White House, not only between the foreign leaders with the presidents, but also among U.S. officials. And he donated his papers to the Ford Presidential Library. And those notes are out now. And I had a great opportunity when I interviewed him. I actually congratulated him on his note-taking because he went word for word. You see, when Kissinger took notes, he did summaries.
Mm-hmm.
And when you summarize a conversation, you can take out things that you'd rather people not see, and certainly that happened. But my research began 5.5 years ago, and it came out of just a really intellectual curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And I pursued it to the point where I realized I really had something unusual here.
And what came out of that, I'm sorry we're out of time, Andrew, is the new book, The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. Andrew Scott Cooper, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.